Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favourite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes.
Welcome to Pax Britannica, the Scottish Revolution interview series. The Kirk, the Covenanters, and the Revolution with Dr. Chris Langley. Welcome to the Pax Britannica Scottish Revolution interview series. In this episode, I'm thrilled to speak with Dr. Chris Langley, reader in early modern history at Newman University, Birmingham. Dr. Langley has published multiple books and articles over the last few years, but of particular interest to this series is his work co-editing The National Covenant in Scotland, 1638-1689, of which he also contributed a chapter. Listeners of Pax Britannica can purchase this collection at a 40% discount by going to Boydell & Brewer's website and entering the code BB870. This applies to both the physical and digital copies. Dr. Langley is also a co-director of the Mapping the Scottish Revolution project. More details for all of these resources can be found in the show notes, as well as on the website, paxbritannica.info. Dr. Chris Langley, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Sam. It's nice to be here.
So you've recently edited a collection on the National Covenant, which brought the work of several quite brilliant historians together. And from what I've seen, it's been incredibly well received. So could you explain your thinking behind that book? What was your aim when you were putting it together? And how does it fit within the historiography?
Okay, this is the classic book pitch, isn't it? The first conversations about that book came in a conference in Belfast in 2015, where it was becoming apparent that a lot of the assumptions about the National Covenant, about the middle of the 17th century, not just in Scotland, but in Britain and Ireland more generally, were, I wouldn't say out of date, I think that would be cruel, but I would say that maybe some of the interpretations were changing. And really, my purpose for trying to bring those people together in that book was to emphasise how good the quality of scholarship was in terms of the material that these people were using. There was a lot of archival material that scholars outside of Scotland probably wouldn't have understood, let alone been aware of. And also it felt like a time where every time I went to a conference about 17th century or early modern religious thought or political thought, there always seemed to be a big Scottish contingent there. But it also meant that it looked like the time was right to contribute something to a much broader conversation. And so initially, what I wanted to do was create a sequel to the Celtic Perspectives of the British Civil Wars, really, which was, I think, published sometime in the 1980s. And so I just thought that the scholarship on Scotland and Ireland in particular moved so much since then that I wanted to provide some sort of corrective for that. And actually, even just as a postscript, even since that conference and that thought entered my head in a pub, of course, the scholarship has moved on even since then. So really, that volume is a snapshot in time from around 2015, 16. And even if we produced it today, I think it would offer different insights. So yeah, it's just an effort to distill this new range of scholarship and to showcase some of the really cool things that were happening, especially in university graduate schools at the time, that weren't getting the airing that I thought they should. I mean, in terms of the historiography of this and where this fits in, this idea of trying to move people's ideas of the National Covenant away from some of the kind of outdoor preaching stereotypes, things like that, these firebrands, of which there were many, by the way. You don't want to go to lunch with any of these people. But what we do want to emphasise is that covenanting is a much more complex thing than just signing on the dotted line or putting your hand up in church one Sunday and maybe getting a bit teary about it in the middle of Edinburgh. It was more a case of, as the political landscape changed around the people that subscribed and swore to that document, that their responses to that act changed as well. So what you have is a landscape that was incredibly fluid, and that fluidity then continued after the Restoration in 1660, where because of the kind of shifting landscape around them, it forced changes and contortions in how people responded. So basically, even though the National Covenant, as you might see from the cover of the book, there's a little extract from the Solemn League and Covenant on the cover, even though its text gives us this sense that things are solid and that it's a static, has a static meaning and thereby should have one interpretation, what actually is going on there is that text gets kind of contorted to the different historical and political realities going on at the time. And in fact, even some of the real firebrands struggle with this stuff, you know. So in pulpits, you get ministers who were, which is one of my particular interests, you have ministers who are really struggling to gauge kind of what the hell has happened politically and what that means for how they understand the covenant, or the covenants, I should say. So the book is about trying to underscore the variation in those responses, and that for scholars outside of Scotland in particular, to get the message home that the covenant wasn't a one-dimensional document and it isn't a one-dimensional document to this day.
It's interesting that you highlight how the almost woolly, vague nature of the covenant, which I'm imagining was something of an advantage when you were getting signatures and you were getting initial support, but when it actually came to applying it, you're saying it became much more fractious because everyone had come to believe their own personal interpretation of the covenant, which didn't necessarily mesh with everyone else's.
Yes, I would say that the definition of that of the document was woolly, but the individuals involved in framing it had some quite specific ideas about what they thought it was. So that kind of wooliness, I would sort of prefer the word variation, I suppose, because there are an awful lot of values being fed into that document in 1638. And the work of Alan McInnes, has really contributed to that conversation, that we know there's a huge group of people behind the creation of that document. But when it gets to the application of it, when it gets to the understanding of it personally, that's when the tire hits the road, if you like, because it's one thing signing up to something when you can sign up to it and have these quite kind of broad notions about anti-Catholicism and things that the Scottish public, as Laura Stewart has suggested, broadly agreed upon, hence the enthusiastic response. But when it comes to testing those ideas, even in things like day-to-day exchanges with what you think your minister is saying in his pulpit, or, you know, when an army comes into town and, you know, they're meant to be an opposing army, but maybe, you know, you're related to them in some way. So, you know, forcing these on-the-spot decisions about what your allegiance to that document meant. And to me, the really important thing here is that the actions that people were taking in responding to these kind of day-by-day challenges, they didn't see them as contradictory to the subscription that they'd made. Mm. So they could... There's been so much anthropological work on this in a wider context, but people can hold these contradictory views and not see them as contradictory. So that's really one of the things about the volume, was that to try to not scoff at that variation, and to understand that the complexity in how people were understanding that document, the casuistry involved in it the moral torture for some people who are taking this very seriously. This is, you know, clearly not a joke. You know, this is an oath that they were swearing in church, sometimes at the same time as a communion celebration. You know, the layers of meaning just are constantly adding up, and the contortions people were forced into were really quite difficult decisions for them. So again, the book emphasizes that really personal aspect of covenanting as well as its collective nature.
So on Pax, we've already covered the Scottish Crisis and the Bishops' Wars, and we've seen the formation of the Tables and the Committee of Estates. I was wondering if you would be able to expand on the role of the Kirk and of ministers in these developments, in these events. Were Kirk ministers involved at every level? Was support from the Kirk not monolithic? Was there division within the Kirk even at this early stage?
Yeah, that taps into some of my interests from over the years, really. So yeah, the Kirk's involvement is in this is well stated, but again, there are a mixture of responses, and I sometimes have problems with how to phrase this, and I feel like every version of this I've developed is a bit of a cop-out, because I do think that there are divisions within that church. Now, clearly there's the really obvious one of those ministers who just didn't agree with covenanting, full stop. That's clearly a problem, and this is the group that Andrew Lind would refer to as royalists. But really, that even within the group of ministers who see covenanting as a holy good act and consistent with their position as ministers and good Protestants, again, there's like a variation in thought there. So, for example, the real pivotal moment is the Glasgow Assembly at the end of 1638, where again it forces ministers it flushes certain ministers out, and this becomes a bit of a trend in the 1640s in Scotland into the 50s. Where the church would make a political decision that took them one way or the other. They have these kind of crossroads. And the crossroads at the Glasgow Assembly in 1638 is about bishops. Prior to that, the covenanting movement would consist of people who had a range of opinions on episcopacy. And then you see this at the Glasgow Assembly. Alex Campbell's work has shown this really well, with the most notable person who enters dissent about considering episcopacy illegal, which is Robert Bailey at Glasgow, or Irvine rather. But there are a whole group of other people, especially from Angus and the Mearns, who are at the Glasgow Assembly and clearly have scruples about saying no to episcopacy. Now, of course, keep in mind that a lot of these guys had taken an episcopal oath earlier in their career. They'd been ordained by bishops. But also there are others who saw bishops as totally consistent with the church. And so this is all based upon a reading of Scottish Protestant history from the previous, you know, 100 years or so, that suggested that, you know, maybe bishops were okay. Maybe, you know, what did Knox mean when he put superintendents in the church? Were they bishops? And what you end up with at the Glasgow Assembly is a really kind of choreographed argument about reading Scottish church history in a certain way to try to emphasise the fact that, you know, maybe bishops don't belong in it. And the choreographed nature of what happens at the Glasgow Assembly, with all these outbursts of emotion, with people swearing the covenant, swearing allegiance to the cause, kind of galvanises that quite extreme and radical agenda within the Assembly. But it also pushes into the background some of those dissenting voices. In fact, when Hamilton, the moderate, the King's Commissioner at the Assembly, walks out, a number of those ministers go with him. Mm. And people regularly kind of skirt over that. So there's clearly concern within the church about to what extent can they reconcile episcopacy in the Scottish church. And then there are others who, even though you might not refer to them as royalists, have issues with perhaps defying the king in a stronger way as they have done. And there are a lot of issues there. So at the strongest end of the spectrum, you have ministers saying that perhaps covenanting is a traitorous act. But there are others who just decide that they don't want to talk about it. And so they get a reader in their church, or an assistant, or a psalm singer, or someone. They just get somebody else to say the words for them. And this is kind of like this wiggle room for, well, how can I keep my job while kind of going with the wind, is a pretty common thing. And as the 1640s progresses and then into the 1650s, what you get is these moments where the church leaders decide that they're going to set traps. It's culminating in 1648, where the church leadership in the Commission of the General Assembly decides that they're actually going to start punishing ministers who remain silent or ambiguous in their preaching about these political events. And so there's this tradition in Scottish preaching since Knox in the 16th century, where Scottish ministers will talk openly about politics. Now, in Geneva, that doesn't happen. It's like you get fished out really quickly in Geneva if you talk about politics. And the Covenanting thing sort of pushes that in a direction where the authorities start to almost attempt to force a uniformity in political thought out of the pulpit. And of course, that's all well and good on paper, but when it comes to, you know, actually preaching it out loud, discussing it with your parishioners, the edges are a little bit rougher than maybe the legislation suggests. So, yeah, the divisions within the ministry are royalist covenanter, fine, but also within those guys who signed the covenant, and also the guys who were really enthusiastic about it, there's disagreement about what that means, what it means to be a covenanter and what it means to be a good minister. And that permeates their day-to-day behaviour in all sorts of ways.
That's really interesting. With the General Assembly in 1638, the reputation of it as sort of a unanimous thing with the disagreements brushed over, is that the case with the later assemblies in 1639 and 40 and 41? Were these just as deceptively unanimous, or was there actual unanimity at this point?
Yeah, it's a great question. The 39 assemblies, I would argue, and we've said privately before, that it's an underrated assembly, I would suggest. And so 38, the Glasgow Assembly gets a lot of attention, and I'm guilty of that as much as anybody, as sort of promulgating some of that attention. But it becomes, 1638 becomes this hagiographical moment for the Scottish Church, with future historians, in particular in the 1800s, talking about this kind of tradition of covenanting in Scotland, and it was ever thus and that sort of thing. Whereas we've obviously discussed that lack of unanimity in areas in 1638. But it's really 1639 when you get, well, clearly the king and the covenanters are staring each other out and playing chicken with each other. But it's really 1639 when you have the ratification of all of the acts that were, quote, passed at the Glasgow Assembly. And so the selection of the King's Commissioner in John Stuart, Earl of Tricare, is telling, really, in that that's obviously the Royal Commissioner, but Tricare's relationship with the King and with the Covenanters is an interesting one. And the fact that Tricare sort of signs away, he signs off on these acts, he signs away the King's right to do certain things, much to the King's disappointment, I would suggest, is a telling one. And it's this moment when, and I think Tricare sees the way the wind is blowing, this is the moment when the Covenanters take control. And indeed, actually what you start to see with depositions of ministers, so those ministers being removed from their posts because of political crimes or perceived political crimes, the majority of them aren't removed in 1638, they're removed in 1639. And they're removed in 1639 because effectively what happens is the Glasgow Declaration abolishing episcopacy is promulgated properly in Scotland at the start of 1639, and it gets out quickly. And then you start to get, you have all of the orders with the bishops being removed, but you also get presbyteries taking it into their own hands to start judging ministers around them. And some of these guys were not, at least publicly, or rather in the records that we have, in the crosshairs in 1638. So they'd had a little bit of a chance to see people's reactions to the covenant in 1638, in the early part of 1639. And then in between the promulgation of the Glasgow Declaration and the 1639 General Assembly in August in Edinburgh, you get this moment where there's this kind of action taking place within presbyteries in Scotland. And effectively what the August 1639 General Assembly does is it serves to rubber stamp what's happened in those presbyteries and then start taking it further. So effectively what the 1639 Assembly does is it draws a line in the sand and says, that's what uniformity is, and this is how you're going to judge it. And so it's a really big moment for the Church of Scotland. And what you then get, and that this is incredibly telling, is that when the 1640 Assembly happens, which is right at the height of the crisis in the Second Bishops' War, you know, you don't have many of the leading figures there because they're with the army on the border. But you have this moment where there's no royal commissioner. So in 1638, you've got James Hamilton of Hamilton. In 1639, you've got Stuart of Tregare. And then in 1640, the king doesn't appoint anyone. And this is a really important moment because it suggests for the first time that, of course, the Covenanters can act without the king's commissioner there. So even when they were acting without James Hamilton present in Glasgow at the end of 1639, they did it with the sort of tacit understanding that, yes, they oversee the church, but also that, well, he'd opened the meeting and he'd left kind of in error. Whereas in 1640, nobody turns up, nobody rocks up, and they just crack on. And so that's a really important moment where almost, you know, 1641, 1642, 1643 assemblies all have a royal commissioner. And then in 1644, there isn't one. So these moments when there's no royal commissioner is actually making quite an important statement about how the church, at least officially, saw itself and how it kind of perceived itself in relation to royal authority. So, and I would argue that 1639 is a really important threshold that we as historians probably don't promote enough, I would suggest.
That's really interesting.
It's really unusual, Sam, for someone to General Assembly is interesting. it's a specialist subject. But yeah, it is something that I think has a wider resonance with understanding 17th century politics and within a kind of British and Irish context, because, of course, all of those meetings of leading clerics, whether it's, you know, the sort of meeting of bishops, convocation in England, whether it's the various meetings that take place in the Church of Ireland that historians have written about previously, they all say something about the church's respective relationships with the monarch. And because Charles pushes, you know, this quite 1637, 1638, has pushed this idea of a English-style quasi-royal supremacy on the Scottish Church, the fact that the 1639 Assembly and then the 1640 Assembly, obviously without a commissioner, sort of sidesteps that supremacy issue. The really wonderful thing is they never really talk about it. They never straight up talk about royal supremacy in Scotland and the fact that what they're doing is kind of against that. But the Assembly's actions offer those words to us, if you like. The Assembly's actions are the text that we have to use to show that they're sending out a message about royal supremacy here.
With the Assembly in 1640, did Charles plan to send someone? Or was it always assumed by the Kirk that, well, we'll be at war then, so what happens then? I'm really curious about the background of this.
The logistics of the 1640 Assembly are superbly interesting. So it takes place at the end of July and the start of August 1640. It is never meant to take place then. So they kind of, you know, there's so many arrangements going on that the timing of it is just superb. And I always have to remind myself of this. So if you think about the timing of the 1640 Assembly, it's the shortest assembly of the decade. And I don't know if that's something to shout about or not, but it is telling because the assemblies tend to take a month to talk about things. Now, and these are huge logistical events, you know, like they complain in Glasgow in 1638 that there aren't enough hotels. You know, there aren't enough inns and taverns for the minister to hang out in. They have to, I mean, if you imagine a representative from every presbytery of Scotland, and oftentimes, I mean, sometimes they send three, they just send sort of backups. You know, it's like Victorian football. There's just guys running behind each other, you know, just in case he gets ill, or, you know, I've got a private advisor coming with me or something. And then you've got the lay commissioners as well. These are huge events. So they can actually bring quite a lot of money in for an area, but you need to be in a borough that can absorb that. So these always take place in Glasgow, Edinburgh, Aberdeen, St Andrews. You know, they're not taking place in Dunbar, you know what I mean? And that's no disrespect to Dunbar, but they're also not taking place in somewhere like Perth. So there are messages there, but in terms of the logistics of 1640, you get a new moderator who is hugely experienced as a minister, but he doesn't take the status of moderator again, because a lot of the leading ministers, a lot of the what I might argue to be the leadership of the Kirk at that point, they were not in Aberdeen in 1640. The meeting really, I mean, they ship it up to Aberdeen, so it's away from any risk, so it's away from the border, effectively, in case it's shut down or something. And then in terms of the Royal Commissioner, because the meeting is moved, Charles doesn't appoint one. I mean, and they are at war at that point. I mean, they're on a war footing from the summer, effectively. So there is no indication of that. And in Charles's judgment, not sending a royal commissioner is a strong message that this isn't approved. This is not under the umbrella of royal supremacy. So by Charles not sending a royal commissioner, he's sending a strong message relating to his position and his lack of sanction on that assembly. And, you know, for Charles, that sort of symbolic action was quite important. And I think sometimes this, he doesn't get the credit for this he deserves, despite so much mismanagement in other areas. One of Charles's traits in his political exchanges, as Richard Custer's shown in his biography of Charles I, is that Charles, he loves a little bit of divide and rule. And when he's at Glasgow, he's trying divide and rule at the Glasgow Assembly. He tells Hamilton that. And I think what he's trying to do in 1640, I mean, this isn't a very well thought out plan, but by not sending a royal commissioner, there is this opportunity that he can flush out people who don't like the fact that they're holding an assembly without a royal commissioner. So he does this all the time with things where he's trying to force those people who are kind of wavering or moderate. He always tries to go for the moderate middle and to try to force them into a decision. Now, of course, at the same time that's happening, the church leadership is presenting questions for ministers and congregants in Scotland that are pushing them more in the extreme direction. So what you end up with is these crossroads where people are forced to make a choice. And those choices become more murky the further in time they move. Now, but for the 1640 Assembly, I mean, it lasts for about a week, you know, and keeping in mind, like, the opening prayer, the closing prayer, the prayer at the start of the day, the prayer at the end of the day. I mean, they don't get a lot done. 1640, ultimately, I mean, the thing that I'm most interested in 1640 is that they actually rubber stamp at the Aberdeen Assembly how future assemblies should behave. So I think that it's an important assembly in terms of the logistics of how people were meant to behave at future assemblies, but in terms of flushing out political opponents, drawing lines in the sand about political opinions, it's 1639 where they really lay the groundwork for that.
In the second half of 1641, Charles visits Scotland, and it's an eventful visit. But how was he received by the Kirk during this visit? This is the first time he's been in Scotland since the early 1630s, and that went about as well as you might have expected. So I'm curious, like, did he get welcomed with open arms? Did this question of the royal supremacy come up again, or was it again quietly sidestepped?
Yeah, so this is an opportunity for the Covenanters and the Covenantian leadership to prove their credentials, their loyal credentials, their bona fides. So there are rumors that there are some extreme individuals within the movement who are going in really radical directions, who would consider this a problem, would consider his visit a problem. But, you know, they are very much a minority. And you can tell that they're a minority because their views are not uttered in record books. So actually what you end up with is, at least in this part of the 1640, you know, any kind of reflection on Charles, including during his visit here, they all emphasise loyalty. They all emphasise the fact that, you know, the church is totally loyal to him, that the individuals within the church are preaching against him. And his visit, almost perversely, offers the Covenanters an opportunity, especially some of the leading Covenanters. It offers them this window of opportunity to show that they are not seditious, to show that actually they're the moderates, you know? And so any kind of dissenting voices from that, any of the real hotheads will get into trouble for that. Now, and this sort of thing isn't expressed. So this sort of links to some of the stuff that I'm interested in how ministers behaved in assemblies, in that the Covenanters were obsessed with appearing moderate. And we think about them now through the lens of Cameronians, the Killing Times, and things like that in the later part of the 17th century, these real zealots, you know, dying for their faith. But in this part of the 1640s, they are absolutely desperate to show themselves as the moderate group. And in fact, they don't want to appear as a faction. They just want to appear to be the voices of moderation in a world that has gone badly out of skew. And so, and this manifests itself in how they view their history. So this is the period where they're reading John Knox and his History of the Reformation in Scotland, and they are trying to reconcile who on earth Knox is for them. And this is almost like our contemporary interest in statues today, in trying to reconcile what those potent symbols mean to the modern era. And so you've got leading Covenanters in the 1640s talking about John Knox and emphasizing the legality of his protest, for example. And there's one example where, you know, they really then struggle when Knox talks about potentially overthrowing monarchs, you know, like that old thing. So what you end up with is there's a really almost outrageous exchange in print where you have an author saying or suggesting that all of those comments Knox made about removing monarchs, removing magistrates who aren't reformers, maybe Knox didn't even write that stuff. So what you end up with is, in the case of Knox, they come up with at least four different versions of John Knox, because they are trying to emphasise, look, this we're related to this guy, we're part of his lineage. Keep in mind as well that you have ministers still, you have ministers active in the 1640s who trace their lineage, their blood, back to Knox. You know, there are people called John Knox in Midlothian who are related to John Knox, you know? You have his relatives across sort of south of Forth, effectively, whether that's in Ayrshire or whether that's in East Lothian. And so they have to reconcile where they fit with this lineage of descent, effectively. And that's kind of a microcosm of this bigger issue. You know, they want to be moderates. They don't, I mean, you often say this in kind of political thought, that the real radicals don't see themselves as radicals. They see themselves as reinstating or restoring the status quo. That's what they do. Now, that's really difficult for us to swallow now, especially when, you know, how can these people considering themselves moderates fall down in tears in a General Assembly meeting? But that part of their kind of Protestant worldview, their theological kind of views on emotion feed directly into this idea that, that's absolutely a legitimate way to encourage moderation. You know, crying and getting down on your knees and referring to your eyes as melting when you're crying is a perfectly okay thing to do if it's in the search of moderation. So what you have in 1641 is an absolutely gilt-edged opportunity for the Covenanters to show that they are the moderates that they have been saying they are. And just one last thing on this, keep in mind that William Lord, when describing the 1638 General Assembly in Glasgow, referred to Alexander Henderson as the moderator without moderation, trying to kind of paint him as this zealot. So in 1641, this is the opportunity to say, hey, put a human face to the Covenanting movement and to emphasize and underscore this idea that they're the moderates here. And it's people like Lord who are the zealots who have taken the king out of shape, if you like. So, yeah, it's a big opportunity and you don't hear much dissent from that.
Did this idea of moderation and this belief that they were moderate, how long did that survive? Did it ever die? Was it constantly a part of the covenanting movement?
Well, I can speak for the middle of the century. I mean, there's clearly some who you might say kind of revel in that radicalism and who see themselves as outside the establishment. But even within that idea that Covenanting generally, if you go back to the text, even though there's various ways of reading that text, the kernel of it is about restoring a purity, and protecting a truth that the Scottish Church has within it somewhere, and that it just needs to be polished up. Now, the extent to which you're polishing up, the shape of your polishing up, that's the bit that's open to interpretation. But in the 1640s, the idea of moderation remains. And so what you have with the Solemn League and Covenant, for example, in the middle of the 1640s, is that a number of people who were very, very happy and eager subscribers to the National Covenant in 38-39, they see the subscription of the Solemn League and Covenant as a bit too radical. And they think that this is not the moderate course they want. And one of the reasons for this is that they, you know, they're not seeing this as a, what's it sometimes called, as a marriage of convenience or a pragmatic relationship. You know, there are some ministers in the church who don't give a monkey's about that. There are some ministers in the Scottish Church who think that aligning with the independents in England, the schismatics as they're calling them, is a deeply problematic act that is too radical. And so those guys start to be removed from the church effectively. And then again in the later 1640s, when there's an agreement with sort of pseudo-royalists in Scotland in the engagement, Christmas 1647 into 1648, again, it forces this moment of reckoning of, well, how are we meant to band up with these royalists when, you know, we've been fighting them? Or how am I not meant to band together with them when they're my brothers? So there's this huge kind of jostling for position. But in all of that, I think the question of moderation is a really interesting kind of lens through which you can look at this, because what you have here is people making these decisions, especially ministers, who are trying to thread a needle. And that needle obviously moves for each individual, but that needle is bounded oftentimes by the idea of moderation, because they are terrified of being the radical. And in Scotland in particular, Scott Spurlock has shown this really, really well recently in his work, the Scottish Church was broadly obsessed with the idea of a national church. The idea of schism, the idea of a separate rival church emerging, scares people deeply in Scotland. So what you end up with is, even in the 1650s, when the church hemorrhages, you get the guys who split away from the church saying, well, but we haven't really split. You know, we're just trying to fix it. And they are at pains to suggest that they are not separatists, because all of their reading of biblical history, all of their reading of Anabaptism in 16th century continental Europe, all suggest to them that separatism is a bad thing. Sorry, to use the 1066 and all that. So separatism is a bad thing, capital B, capital T. So the Scottish Church is very interested in that idea of one national church. There is a church in Scotland. And this idea of moderation really plays into that, that you don't want to be a separatist. It's not just about, it's not just putting lipstick on a pig. It's not suggesting that, oh, this is window dressing, this is for show. It's actually that, you know, they genuinely believe that separatism is a problem, and therefore the way to prevent that separatism is through moderation and restraint. And this comes to a head in 1648, when the church has a serious split over this, and the commission and the General Assembly tries to frame its opposition to the engagement in 1647-48 as a way of navigating perilous waters with rocks on either side. That is the phrasing that they usually come out with, because they know they're trying to thread this needle and they know it's difficult. And sometimes I think by the time you get to the late 1640s, some of them are starting to realize what an outrageous way of behaving this is, that you have to keep shifting your kind of moral compass. And it starts to become a problem when you have to make a public declaration of that, because they know that they're going to have parishioners point at them from the stalls or the pews saying, well, 2 years ago you said this, you know? And so this emphasis on moderation does continue, but it's squeezed in ways that make people very, very uncomfortable.
So just to finish off, and keeping in mind our recent focus on the idea of remaining a moderate, in your view, was there a Scottish Revolution?
We're going to need a bigger boat. Yeah, I think there was. I always come back to a conversation that I had as an undergraduate, where I, and maybe people who know me have heard this story loads of times, I'm really sorry if they're listening, but I remember a conversation as an undergraduate I had with my supervisor, and I was trying to be contrary and explain why there wasn't a revolution in England in the middle of the 17th century. And he turned around to me and he said, they cut the guy's head off and that was sort of it. Now, that weird little conversation there. In a Scottish context, obviously, they don't subscribe a warrant to execute the king. There are these kind of these emphases on loyalty. But, you know, revolutions are described by people after the event, and we have different criteria from those at the time. And while I'm not suggesting that those emphases on moderation were feigned, they weren't, they clearly believed them, they believed what they were doing. I think this constant asking of questions about, well, where do you stand now? Where do you stand on this changing issue? What you have is this hill that they all start going down, this snowball effect. And the more and more they're asked about, well, what's your stance on it? You know, declare where you are now, tell everyone, swear on this, you know, all these quite traditional acts, you know, declarations, proclamations, and oaths have much longer histories in Scotland in particular. But every time they ask one of those questions, you know, the temperature goes up a little bit. And ultimately, by the time, despite what happens in the 1660s, where, you know, there are revocations and acts of oblivion on what's happened between 1638 and 1660, as Alan Kennedy in the National Covenant volume that I edited suggests, that restoration state not only has to deal with the memory of those years, but it also absorbs some of the things that it's facing, and it absorbs some of the almost learnings of that. So the desire to turn back time, if you like, I mean, that might be one desire in some cases, but what you actually have in 1660 is a very different situation than you had in 1638, where they don't forget this. And often historians talk about forgetting as, how could people forget? It would be impossible because so many people died. And that's absolutely one way to look at it. But in terms of people being made to declare their political allegiances very publicly in this period, is something that they don't turn the clock back on. And in these kind of the squaring up to the state, the squaring up to political authority, that doesn't change either. So what you've got here is, I've argued this before, there's a deep continuity in some of the practices in terms of religion that go on. People use those as a form of kind of comfort, I suppose, and a touchstone. Parochial discipline doesn't change that much across this period. But overall, I mean, yeah, the changes that accumulate over this 22-year period are revolutionary. Now, we can pick up go into the weeds on what that means, on what the word revolution means, but I mean, this is 22 years of turbocharging political thought that they cannot take back. And I would argue, as Alan Kennedy does, probably better than I would, that they, in some cases, they don't want to turn back everything. They don't want to turn back all of those changes. And one might argue that they know they can't. The early modern state knows its limitations. And so what you end up with in 1660 is, a period where they are still living with the consequences of what's happened for those previous 22 years. So in short, yes, this is a revolution.
What a brilliant answer to end on. Thank you so much for coming on, Chris. This has been super, super interesting.
Thanks for inviting me, Sam. And I'm pleased you found it interesting, even the bit about assemblies.